it's surprising to me that we're already at the end of the book. We started this, 8 weeks ago, 7, 8 weeks ago. And it seemed like, man, this whole book is going to take forever. And parts of it have seemed long and parts of it have seemed really quick. But I'm mostly sad because of just how powerful the book is even today. And not just because of how it speaks truths to us today, but even just how central the understanding the book of Acts is to understanding the rest of what Paul writes and really the rest of the New Testament. It's kind of like the mind map hub, if you've done anything with that, for the rest of the New Testament. So it's a really important book, and hopefully it understanding this book better helps you understand the rest of the things that you'll be reading in the New Testament. I want to start today with the story of an unnamed friend, and he is unnamed because I want to avoid him having to experience the embarrassment. One time, I had this bright idea to go whale watching, but out of Monterey, you can take kayaking trips right up into the gray whales, right? And it's like, I mean, they're, you know, 40 feet, 10 feet, like however far away you happen to be blessed with them. And I thought, this sounds awesome. And so I had one other insane friend who decided to go with me. The other six I talked to thought it was nonsense. And so they didn't. And when we got there, the tour guide, the professional ocean kayaker guy said, y'all, she's got some pretty gnarly waves today. I don't know if this is a good idea. And what I've learned from this experience is if a professional ocean kayaker says that there are some gnarly waves, we shouldn't do it. Probably that's when you pull the plug. But this unnamed friend and I decided that wasn't what we should do. And so we went out. And long story short, he and I are both somewhat experienced kayakers and got tossed into the ocean 3 times in like an hour and had to be sort of escorted back with the tour guide's hand on our boat to make sure that we didn't tip again. It was mostly embarrassing, but also terrifying. We were probably only 2 miles off the coast, but this is April in the Pacific. It is not meant for swimming. And the sea was angry that day, my friends. It was intimidating and powerful and humbling. And we quickly realized, even though there are all these boats around and we're not really in any danger, we're just cold and uncomfortable and embarrassed. This is not to be trifled with. And this is as close in my life as we have to a story of what we read in from Paul in Acts 27. Here is a man who has a thing start with kind of this gentle breeze that turns into the Greek is typhonic. Like these are some like storms, right? This isn't just like rough water, but these are some gnarly waves today. And this turns into this like 14-day storm where Paul, though a very seasoned traveler, is going to most likely be surrounded by these people who are terrified of the ocean and of the power. And if you've been stranded 2 miles off the coast in just your little life jacket and waves that seem as high as the sky crashing down on your face, you get a sense of just the power that is just sitting latent in the ocean. And so here's Paul, 14 days of this storm. It says that they didn't see the sun or the moon or the stars for 14 days. They weren't able to eat. They're chucking all their tackle and all of their supplies off the boat because they're just trying to lighten it up. And they're just drifting through the Adriatic Sea, really with no direction. And it says in verse 20, finally, all hope was fading that we would be saved. And so all of these people that are in the boat are terrified, and they're just sure they're just going to die. They don't know where they are. They can't get their bearings. They're just lost at sea. And then finally, some good news happens. Finally, they shipwreck, which doesn't ever sound like good news, but they shipwreck. And when they do, they're able to kind of swim to the shores of Malta. And so those who can swim, swim, and those who can't, they put on little like chunks of debris from the broken ship, and they float into town or into the coast. It's interesting that Luke, the writer of Acts, gives so much detail on this passage, right? Why on just this journey, this boat ride, why does he give so much attention to this? It's an entire chapter and a half, and Paul's been all over the world. Why does he give so much detail about this? Especially when you see that it doesn't seem to really, on the surface, matter much. It doesn't progress the theology or the doctrine or the story or the ministry of Paul. It really just seems like a lot of details that we can't put in good order. Luke doesn't go into this much detail with any of the other stories. When Peter or Paul or whoever is rescued from prison. It's just kind of like, yeah, an angel came and he got him out of there. When he's performing miracles, it's like the guy couldn't walk and now he can. It's just kind of like these real kind of scant details. And all of a sudden he gives this radical amount of detail. And we have to ask why. And I think it's because it sits in such stark contrast, such like direct opposition to what we read in 23:11, which is Jesus coming to Paul and saying, you will testify in Rome as you did in Jerusalem. And so there's this promise that Luke is trying to protect on behalf of Jesus, that he's heard this promise through Paul, and he's trying to make sure that we understand that Jesus is not one to fail his promises. And so as we go through this thing, there are so many opportunities in this chapter for Jesus' promise that Paul will make it to Rome to testify before Caesar to not come true, that you are a fool, dare I say, if you think it's just bad luck. And my wife and I have plenty of bad luck travel stories. We've had flat tires in the mountains of Rocky Mountain National Park. Our honeymoon is a story that I can't tell on Facebook, not for the reasons you might think. We were once caught in a tropical storm while camping on the coast of Maine. Our tent literally blew across the ground and a tree fell on our neighbors. Like, we've had some dark travel stories. Once we were stuck at the ticketing counter of an airport for 23 hours with seven other missionaries trying to get to South Africa, had to get pizza delivered to the ticket counter. We've had some bad travel stories, but nothing like what Paul experiences. And we see in Paul, or in Acts 19:21, Paul basically tells us, hey, I want to go to Rome. And after I make a quick pit stop in Macedonia and Jerusalem, I'm on my way to Rome. Now, he wasn't planning on doing it as a prisoner. He was planning on just going on his own. But Luke tells us all of these details, I believe, of Paul's story so that we can contrast all of the things that are happening to stop this promise of God from happening and the full realization of God's promise. And so here are the Cliff's Notes for what Paul endures during that time. He arrives in Jerusalem. This is after 19:21. He arrives in Jerusalem. Shortly thereafter, he is arrested. He has to endure at least five trials between different governors and so on to try to receive freedom. He's imprisoned in Caesarea. He lives through two assassination attempts. He's lost at sea for 14 days in a hurricane. Prison guards that are on the ship want to kill him because if they escape, then the prison guards are the ones that are responsible and have to incur the same sort of punishment that the prisoners would have received. So they want to kill him. They chuck everybody overboard. They swim in. He's bitten perhaps by a snake that is poisonous, so maybe poisoned by a snake. And then he arrives in Rome and is still imprisoned for 2 years. That is a god-awful travel experience, but a great story. Right? And I think Luke tells it to show God's providence, to show how God provides and is faithful to the words that he gives. He tells Paul, you will testify before Caesar. You will testify on behalf of me in Rome. And so that's what we see, that God protects Paul in each of these steps. And that's why I say you are a fool if you think this is just a bad travel story. There are other things at work here. But the reason there are other things at work here is if Paul makes it to Rome, remember, Rome is kind of the epicenter of arts and culture and thought and politics and commerce. If he makes it there, the consequences, the spread of the gospel is going to be just absolutely nutty. It's going to explode. We've talked throughout this series about how really the spread of the gospel is similar to the spread of a disease, right? It's contagious. And once you start to carry it, you give it to other people. And this is the beauty of the gospel and the spread of the gospel. And so if the gospel, if the truth of Jesus makes it to Rome, the epicenter of all these things, art, culture, thought, commerce, it's like landing in LAX, LaGuardia, and Heathrow all at the same time. I mean, it's like it's going to explode. And people know this, and the enemy knows this. While Paul is in Rome, while he's imprisoned, he essentially writes, at least Ephesians, Colossians, Philemon, Philippians. While he's on house arrest, he becomes a veritable seminary. All these people come to him, and he trains them up in the ministry, and he's kind of a spiritual direction retreat center. Like, all these people come to his house, which is like a house arrest prison. He can't come and go. But they just come to him because he can't leave, and he just trains up all these people that know the gospel, that can go and infect the world with the truths of Jesus. his journey, this 1,400-mile boat ride, it's essentially from Manteca to like the middle of Nebraska or the tip of the Baja Peninsula. I would go to Baja. It's just wrought with danger because the last thing that the enemy wants to see happen is for the gospel to take root in Rome, the epicenter of commerce and culture and art and thought. And so as we look through other pieces of scripture that Paul wrote, Ephesians, you know, Ephesians 6 is that idea that our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against rulers and authorities, the powers of dark world against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms is essentially what it says. And the idea here is that, as we've said from the outset, the gospel is not going to be stopped. We talked about one of the main things that we learned from this is that the gospel comes just completely unhinged as it goes into these places. And the more it's tried to, people try to squash it, the more it explodes and the more it grows and the more strength it gets. And so here, Jesus works out the things that conform to his will. And he even engineers evil for the good of those who love him. Yeah? And so finally, when he arrives, we think we're going to get to celebrate the fact that this whole, like, appearing before Caesar thing can be put to rest. We can kind of put a bow on that. And we don't even really get closure to that. It's a weird two chapters. Like, everything is led up to he's going to appear before Caesar in Rome. And he doesn't, at least from what the text tells us, he doesn't appear before Caesar. But what we're left with is that we honestly just have to assume that he met with Caesar, because it would be real weird for Luke to go so far out of his way to point out that God, that Jesus just checks off all the boxes to make sure that one promise happens if he like promised he was going to appear before Caesar and then he didn't, right? Like, Paul wouldn't include that in the book of Acts. And we also know that, or we're pretty sure that Paul was eventually released from prison. So the Caesar at the time was Nero, and just a few years after this, Rome burns to the ground, and most people think, although there's not a lot of evidence, that Nero actually burned Rome. And so before Nero has his nervous breakdown, it's likely that Paul, the apostle, appears before Nero, the most powerful man on earth at the time, and gets to share the good news of Jesus Christ to a person who believes he himself is God, which takes some chutzpah, we'll say, all right? It takes some gall to sit and look at a man who thinks he is a God himself and say, no, 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 let me tell you about my God. Let me tell you about Jesus. So during that 2 years in prison, Paul essentially has this like kind of inverted prison ministry, right? 2 years where people come to him as a prisoner and seek wisdom and seek training and seek knowledge and seek comfort. And there's no doubt that the seeds that he plants in these conversations with these folks are the things that help the church grow. Today, we are 2.1 billion people strong. And as we know, the disciples weren't the cleverest. Paul was a pretty clever cat. Worked hard. Anointed in the Spirit. But to think that 2,000 years later, A, we're still going, and B, there's 2 billion of us. The seeds that were planted because of Jesus promising and ensuring that Paul makes it to Rome are unparalleled. And no matter what the enemy tries to do, shipwreck, killing, snakes, etc., God engineers it all for his good and his glory. So as we try to wrap up all of this book, right, as we wrap this book of Acts, there are a couple things that we started with in our minds. I want to just make sure that we remember, that we are reminded of. And there's 4 things. One, if you've been around Northgate for more than this series, you know that the previous series we talked about that inward, outward, upward, and forward relationship of Jesus, with Jesus. And this is a book that lays that out, right? That talks to us about what that relationship of the church means in kind of enduring ways, that the upward relationship, the inward relationship, the outward and the forward. And so as you look through this book, hopefully you see those relationships being developed. The second thing, hopefully you have seen the just complete unleashing of God's vision for the church, not as a passive sort of backup plan, not as a super sophisticated institution either, but really as just the thing that it is, which is the church is just where we are. And it's so relevant today because we are not together. We are not in the building. You can see it over there. I can see it over there. That's a building. We used to call it a meeting house. The church is here. The church is now here for a time such as this. And so the gospel is not going to be stopped, right? And God's vision for the church is bigger than attendance on Sunday or bigger than a Bible study on Wednesday. It's bigger than that. And he's unleashed this vision that hopefully you see. We are the church wherever we are. And so with that, you see that Paul also he puts into place lots of expectations and responsibilities for us, which is the third point. Hopefully you've seen that God uses everybody in this story, right? Believers and non-believers, Gentiles and Jews, Spiritists and slaves. He uses all of us, which is good and bad news. That means that you have some stuff to do too, right? Like, we are all called into something. We have a role to play in the spread of the gospel. And my hope is that you've started to get some sense of what your role is. It could be feeding the widows. It could be proclaiming to the Gentiles. It could be being a missionary. It could be a person who chronicles all the things that you see happening in the church. I don't know. But my hope is that in the next couple of weeks, as we start a new series on Monday about spiritual gifts, that might help to offer some clarity for you in your own mind about what your role is, because you got one and we need to step into it. We don't all need to preach. We don't all need to serve widows, but somebody's got to do it all. Like, somebody's got to do something. Everybody's got to do something. And so then the final thing, the fourth thing, is this. God is active currently. He wasn't just then, and he's not just now because it's Good Friday and because it's Holy Week. When we started the series, we had no idea that COVID was coming. Like, we had heard about this virus, but this wasn't the plan. This wasn't the plan. But as you look at how active God has been through this, even in spite of this, all the ways that we've been trying to point to God's redemption of this issue, all the ways other churches are trying to mobilize and make sure that we continue to get the good news out because people are desperate and hungry for it, God is on the move. And it's predicted that this Sunday will be the biggest digital experience in history, because we already have 2.1 billion people waiting to celebrate the resurrected Christ. And now we have all these other people who are interested, who are inquisitive, who are wondering about this Jesus, because we're just bombarding people with the good news of the gospel. And folks, this is an act of God. This is not Jesus sitting on the sidelines. This is not us being able to just be done with what we have, be content with what we have, to mail things in. But we are a hungry people for more Jesus, and there are lots of hungry people out there waiting for him as well. So we celebrate with you a little bit ahead of time, the resurrection of Jesus this Easter, and we pray that you would, even over these next couple of days, Good Friday to Easter, that your antenna would be up for the movement of the Spirit in subtle and dynamic ways, and that we wouldn't just let things slip by, that we wouldn't forget to be observant, and that we wouldn't forget to pause and recognize not just Christ's movement then and not just Christ's movement now, but Christ's movement in both directions.